Welcome to the Intelligent Investing Podcast, where modern portfolio theory can suck it. A student of the school of Graham and Doddsville and a clergy member of the Church of Warren Buffett. Here's your host, Eric Schlein.
Hi, this is Eric Schlein. You are listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast. Today we have a pretty cool guest on. His name is Whitney Tilson. Some of you may know him. For those of you who don't know him, I have known, at least been acquaintances with Whitney since I'm maybe 16, 17 years old, and I'm 30 now for some perspective. And this is a guy who's so generous that when I was in high school, I thought maybe I'd want to manage money one day, and I emailed him, and I found his email. And, you know, he sent me an article back that he had written about breaking into the money management industry. And I was like, wow, what a cool guy. And he would always respond to my emails. The very first Berkshire Hathaway meeting that I went to, you know, he said, oh, come to my event that I'm having. And for the next 12 years in a row, I went to events and parties he was hosting in Omaha. So, you know, didn't have to do that, didn't have to spend any energy or time talking to me, but as someone who's really passionate about helping the next generation of value investors, really passionate about empowering people and teaching. You know, he ran a fund for about 20 years and recently shut it down and now started Case Learning, which teaches people how to either learn how to invest, learn how to start a fund. For people like me who are, you know, currently running a firm, learning new ways to grow it. And so just really amazing guy, really generous guy. And Whitney, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Eric. That's a very kind introduction.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about, you know, for people who don't know who you are, tell us a little bit about who you are, your background, and, you know, how you started your fund, and we can go from there.
Sure. Well, I guess going way back, I grew up all over the world. My parents were one of the first couples to meet and marry in the Peace Corps. So lived in Tanzania and Nicaragua for most of my childhood. Ended up in California for a few years, Western Massachusetts, then lived in Boston for 8 years, going to Harvard, a couple years at Boston Consulting Group, a couple years at Harvard Business School. Met and married my wife down there. By the way, was one of the founders of Teach for America. It was my first job out of college.
Pretty amazing.
I've been very involved in education reform and charter schools for about 30 years now, thanks to that. Met and married my wife in Boston. She is from the New York area, so 25 years ago came down here to New York when I graduated from business school. And spent about 5 years running a nonprofit organization out of HBS with a famous professor there, Michael Porter, focused on, it was called the Initiative for a Competitive Inner City. And basically, very late in my life, my parents were both teachers, so they'd never owned a stock in their life. I was always interested in business, but didn't really know much about investing and anything Warren Buffett until probably I was 30 years old. But then in the late 90s, you know, had the first $10,000 of savings of my entire life. Prior to that, I'd had nothing but, you know, school debt. But my wife was working as a lawyer, and we paid off my school loans. And I had the first $10,000 of my life sitting in my bank account because we were living very frugally. And I had to figure out what to do with it. So I called up my friend, Bill Ackman, who I'd gotten to know, as an undergraduate at Harvard. He was one of the early, hedge fund managers with his prior fund called, Gotham Partners. He now runs one of the largest hedge funds in the world called Pershing Square, very, very well-known guy. But, back in the day, you know, I asked him, well, what should I do? I want to invest my $10,000. And he said, go read all of Warren Buffett's annual letters, and you can stop right there. You don't need to read anything else.
Smart guy right there, huh?
Yeah, it was very good advice. And, of course, I didn't stop right there. And so I started reading, you know, Lowell Dean's original book about Buffett, and then started reading about Charlie Munger and reading all the classics of investing, you know, The Intelligent Investor and Security Analysis, you know, Phil Fisher's books, Peter Lynch's books, and I really passionate about investing, and So a couple years later, so I started buying my first stocks, and this was the late 1990s. We're at the tail end of a 17-year bull market. Every stock I picked went up. I thought I was God's gift to investing. So a couple years later, I decided to hang out my shingle as a hedge fund manager, having never worked a day in the industry, not at any bank, not at any financial institution, much less the kind of training you really want, which is working at a hedge fund. If you're going to start your own hedge fund, it's probably a pretty good idea to go work at a bigger hedge fund and get trained and learn the business. It's very much an apprenticeship business. And I short-circuited all of that. I was sort of full of myself and so decided to get into the business. And so I started with $1.1 million from three investors, myself, my parents, and my in-laws. Bill Ackman's dad was my fourth investor, about a month in. He was family. Sort of bootstrapped my way into the business. Long story short, had a very successful first dozen years, tripled the market's returns in a flat market, nailed the internet bubble, nailed the housing bubble, became, fairly high profile, was on CNBC a bunch, was on 60 Minutes, and grew to about $200 million under management, including a couple mutual funds that we started. In addition to hedge funds, got into the investing conference business, the investment newsletter business, and in hindsight, wildly over-diversified myself and got spread way too thin, ended up sort of underperforming this long bull market. Assets shrunk to about $50 million by last fall. And it was after 12 years of almost every year beating the market, trailing the market year after year, was very demoralizing, and I was pretty miserable and fatigued, and my investors were as well. And so, I just said, I'm in a rut, and I can't do this anymore. I got to. So I ended up closing my business last September. But over the years, I've done a lot of teaching, a lot of mentoring young guys like yourself. And I love doing that. I've got, nobody else is doing it. And I've got a lot of experiences to share, both on the things to do right and the things to not do. Had extreme success, but also some real setbacks over the years. That's really valuable experience, that I'm trying to share with the next generation, via my new business case learning.
Very interesting. I just want to ask you about something that I'm kind of curious about. You said that, you were doing mutual funds for a little bit. What had you want to go into the mutual fund business? I've never actually talked to someone who said, I actually did start a mutual fund back in the day.
Yeah, very few people do it, and there's a very good reason for it.
Costs a lot of money, doesn't it?
It costs a fair amount of money. I mean, it is maybe, $50,000 or something like that. But it's also, you have to become a registered investment advisor, you have to be very careful, very restrictive in what you can write to your investors. It's all subject to a much higher degree of scrutiny because you can be out there marketing yourself to the general public. And so that's how it should be.
Right.
But very few hedge fund managers, get into the mutual fund business. It's generally a very large institutional business. You need a sales force for it. I was sort of trying to bootstrap my way into it because I had a fairly high-profile writing gig at The Motley Fool, at TheStreet.com, at Forbes. I was writing for the Financial Times and Kiplinger's for a while. So I was on television a lot via CNBC. So the idea was to create an investment vehicle for average investors. Hedge funds, you can only take high-net-worth accredited investors or qualified investors. Initially it sort of worked okay. I think, the two mutual funds combined, sort of got up to maybe $100 million at their peak. We started our own fund called the Tilson Focus Fund. We partnered up with our friend Zeke Ashton down at Centaur Capital down in Dallas. Mm-hmm. And he set up what was then called the Tilson Focus Fund. It's still in existence and still doing well, called the Centaur Total Return Fund now. In hindsight, I would not recommend that, like for example, going to mutual fund business. These mutual funds, you've got to be either very high profile or you have to have an army of salespeople to sell it and to reach out to all the registered investment advisors and the individual investors. And it was part of what in hindsight turned out to be a very poor business decision, which is I saw opportunities related to my core business, i.e. Hedge funds, in the value investing space. I saw the need for a value investing oriented conference, so I created a investing department, did two big conferences a year. I saw the need for a value-oriented investment newsletter, and so I created with a partner Value Investor Insight, which is still going strong to this day. And I saw the opportunity in mutual funds, which can also be a very good business at scale. What I realize now, though, is that I was in the world's greatest business, hedge funds. Mm-hmm. There was opportunity, and yes, I made some money in these other related businesses, but in hindsight, there are only a certain number of hours in the day. I only have a certain amount of bandwidth, and I ended up getting spread too thin, and I think that was a significant contributor to the demise of my hedge fund business. I diversified, and big corporations do it, and I fell into the same trap.
So what do you think are some other, I do want to talk about case learning in a little bit, but what would you say are some, maybe other mistakes or lessons that you've learned through maybe even doing something right, but you say, in hindsight, I could have even done it better. What are some lessons that you've learned that you're now trying to incorporate into the next phase in your life and things that you might recommend to other people in the industry?
Yeah, there are so many. There was no one thing that led to my tremendous success. And as you well know, almost nobody starts with $1 million out of their bedroom with no experience in the industry and ever breaks out to even much over 10 million, much less 200 million, which is where I got to, right?
Right.
So there were a lot of things I did really right on both the investing side and the entrepreneurial side, building the business. And there were a lot of things that mistakes that I made that eventually caught up with me. So it's a big topic. We teach this over multiple days in our seminars, and now we're now teaching online. I don't know if you're aware, but just yesterday we started our first webinar, so we're now teaching a dozen students from all over the world who are logging in for a live webinar and asking questions and interacting with us and one another, just like the seminar you did where we were in a room together with a group of students. We're now doing that online, which is a pretty exciting new way to teach our materials. So,
how's that been going so far? Doing it online like that.
Well, what we've done is, remind me, Eric, did you just take the one-day seminar on how to launch and build a fund, or did you also do the three-day boot camp?
I just did that one day in New York City.
Right. So we spent one full day together on we have three programs right now, a three-day what we call Lessons from the Trenches Investing Boot Camp, which is focused on how to be a successful investor. Find great stocks, avoid value traps. We have modules on short selling, portfolio management, activism, the emotional side of investing, behavioral finance, right? What do you do when a stock you own goes down by 50%, right? How do you deal with that? So it's a very comprehensive sort of three-day program trying to teach all the investing lessons we learned over the years. Then the program you took is a one-day seminar on how to launch and build an investment fund. So that assumes that you're a good investor, have a good investment strategy.
I'll tell you something, Whitney. One of the things that I have gotten out of it now that it's been a little while is the feedback people have been giving me on my investor letters have been a lot better. Like, oh, wow, you didn't write 20 pages this time. You don't sound like a psycho.
Yes. Well, so one of the modules that you're referring to that we teach in how to launch and build a fund is, we start with the decision, should you try and go out and launch and build your own fund? And by the way, it doesn't have to be a hedge fund. It could be a separately managed accounts business. And by the way, I haven't really told anybody yet, but I'll tell you in this podcast for your listeners, what can be decision I've made.
Oh, you know what? That I'm going to get back. You're cutting out. Start over with that.
Okay. I'll try and speak a little louder, closer to the microphone here. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
I'm going to get back into the money management business in the near future, but I'm not doing it in a hedge fund structure. I'm going to do it via separately managed accounts. And that's a longer discussion we can have and the pros and cons of that from both the investor perspective and the manager perspective. So this one day seminar that you took is, you obviously know what I'm saying here, but I'm rehashing it for your listeners. Focuses on the decision to go, whether to go hang out your own shingle and manage other people's money. And then if you decide you want to go that route, the practical elements of finding a prime broker, setting your fee structure, your redemption terms, who should you hire and when, et cetera. And then the second half of the seminar is focused, okay, now you're Eric Schlein, and you've launched your own fund, but you want to grow it. How do you grow your business? How do you raise money? How do you write good investor letters? How do you put together a good pitch deck? How do you manage through periods of poor performance? So that's a one-day seminar when we teach it in person. And then we also teach a second one-day seminar called an advanced seminar on short selling for people who are interested in learning about that part of investing. So it's a three-day boot camp and two one-day seminars. Most people take it as a five-day program, and we've taught it in person in New York a number of times, and we just taught it in London a couple weeks ago. We're taking this five-day program on the road around the world over the next we're going to 10 cities in the next 10 months around the world, from Tokyo to Hong Kong, Sydney, Australia, Zurich, Sao Paulo, Mexico City, Toronto. We're really covering the globe.
You know what would be interesting, Whitney, is as you travel to maybe, you know, keeping some notes for yourself around the different kinds of I wonder how similar, how different the different kinds of questions and interactions are going to be depending on where in the world you are. Like, it would be a very interesting perspective on how people see investing in the financial markets depending on, you know, what culture they're part of.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And, you know, we just taught in London a couple weeks ago, and there were some different variables about London. Huh. We got bit different questions. It's more difficult to start a fund, just start up your own hedge fund there. It's a little more expensive. You got to be it's more regulated and registered and that kind of thing. In certain parts of the world, there's little or no short selling. In some cases, it's banned. So that may mean we don't teach a one-day seminar on short selling in those countries, right?
Yeah, I can imagine the marketing could be different. I mean, let's say you're in like Japan or something where people do not look at stocks in the same way that Americans or people in England would look at stocks. Right? Like, what's the marketing around buying stocks in Japan? Where, what if we don't do anything for 20 years and we're just flat? Like, I'm sure that's a concern of a lot of Japanese investors, right?
Yes, and look, we're doing. The Japanese and the Chinese are very different investment cultures. Japanese tend to be much more conservative. The Chinese tend to be much more speculators and gamblers.
Yeah. It's crazy how conservative the Japanese, a lot of the Japanese corporations are, where you see these companies. I mean, I'm sure you know this, but companies that have, you know, maybe just very, very small amounts of net income, and then they hold millions and millions of dollars of just like land that's like sitting around doing nothing, and they've been around for 600 years.
Yeah, exactly. and then American activist investors come in and try and get them to, you know, sell the land or buy back stock or something, and they meet a lot of resistance.
Well, because they don't understand the. I mean, a lot of these. No offense to a lot of these American activists, but a lot of them don't understand the culture these management teams are dealing with, and these Japanese management teams are like, you know, F you, like, you don't even understand what we're doing.
Yes. Which is, I mean, look, there's probably, the correct answer is probably somewhere in the middle in that these management, there is a lot of value to be unlocked, in Japan. I have no doubt.
Oh, without question. I mean, if you have a decent company, but the ROE is only 1%, yeah, I'm sure there's value to be unlocked.
Yeah, exactly. So to answer your question from a minute ago about how's the webinar going, the idea, having taught, you know, well over 100 students over the course of a handful of seminars in New York, we realized that there's a huge market out there of people who are really interested in what we're teaching, but they can't take 3, 4, or 5 days off of work. They don't live in New York or London or one of the major cities, so they have, you would have big travel expenses. And because we've had people fly in to take our seminars in New York from literally every corner of the world. And one of the reasons that we're, Glenn and I, my partner Glenn and I, are going to go on the road to teach this is because we see, you know, very big markets, people, you know, tremendous interest in value investing in places like Shanghai and Mumbai and that kind of thing. So, but we realize, you know, the technology now to allow these webinars and teaching online is really pretty incredible, where, you know, where everyone can see each other via a little video tile. So everyone's logged in with video. People can raise their hands. They can ask questions. You know, when one of our students asks a question, we make their video live so everyone can see them ask their questions, and then we reply. So in many ways, we can capture 90% of the in-person experience, but we don't, Glenn and I don't have to travel. We don't have to rent an expensive hotel room, so it's a much lower cost for us. I can do it out of my home office, and for our students, there are huge advantages. They don't have to take days off of work. It's at a significantly lower price point. They don't have to travel to New York. And we've scheduled it, rather than doing full days, we've broken each day into 3 2.5-hour modules. So our boot camp, our 3-day boot camp, is now 9 modules, of which we just taught the first module yesterday, the second module today. And we're doing it from 7 to 9:30 every morning, so that people in the United States can do it before work. People in Europe can do it middle of the day. People in Asia, and we've got people logging in doing this seminar right now, this webinar this morning. Mm-hmm. From we've got a guy in Romania. We've got a guy in Saudi Arabia. We've got a guy in Singapore. We've got people getting up super early at 4 a.m. in Seattle to take it. And it's only a dozen people. We're starting small with a manageable number of people, but so we're doing that for the next 9 mornings. And then we're doing the seminar that you took on how to launch and build an investment fund. We're doing in 3 mornings, August 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. So 3 consecutive mornings. So the same 7.5 hours of content that you got, in person, here in New York a couple of months ago, we're now delivering via this webinar, and we've got 24 people signed up for that, and so far so good. If we can make this webinar work, and I think we can, it's going very well so far. I think this is a way that we can serve a dramatically larger market of people. Because we can, it's much less cost for us, so we can charge quite a bit less for it. So it's much more affordable. People don't have to travel. They don't have to take time off of work. And by the way, if anyone misses one of our sessions, we're recording all of them. So, you know, over the 9-day boot camp, for example, the 9 2.5-hour segments that we're teaching the Lessons from the Trenches boot camp, if somebody misses one or two, it's no big deal. They can just watch the video at a later date. And the only downside is they don't they're not able to ask any questions because they're not doing it live. So we're trying to figure out new, different, and customer-friendly ways to deliver our content. So one additional, at the very high end, you have the in-person, events like the one you attended. Then there's the webinar, and then I think we're going to create, some of what we're teaching on the webinar, some of these videos, we can, create them, and create a video series that people can just pay and watch the videos at an even lower price point, right? But then they're not getting any of the ability to ask questions and the interactions with Glenn or me or their fellow students. But that's okay for some people who can't afford the higher end stuff. So it's pretty cool. Pretty cool the directions in which we're taking this business.
Yeah, that's great. And what would you say are some of the What would you say are some of the highlights of things that students have been getting out of it? You know, things for you that you've been learning. I mean, I'm sure you've been learning as you've been progressing with this. What are some things that you've learned along the way of building case learning?
Yeah, let me break it into investing lessons and then entrepreneurial lessons. On the investing side, we had our period of greatest success when we kept things simple and when we were just trying to find the best dozen stocks out there. And ironically, as we became more experienced, and I'm saying we because part of it was just me and then part of it I had a partner for about 8 years, is that as we achieved success, we made things more complex. We introduced short selling. We started doing more trading. We started buying options. We started owning more stocks. And all of those things, every single one of those things I just mentioned proved to be deadly. They really cost us and contributed to our underperformance and eventually the closure of my fund. But here's the danger is that everything initially when we did these things, it worked. And that's one of the big lessons we teach our students is be very careful of doing, of straying and making things more complex. And especially if you have some success at it initially, because that'll suck you into doing, more of these things and will eventually, cost you dearly.
I'm just curious, Whitney, did you ever, I know you used to ask questions and I think you still do. You used to ask questions at the Berkshire Hathaway meeting, like all the time. I think almost every year I remember you asking a question to Buffett. Did you ever have any conversations, with Buffett or Munger around short selling? Cause I know that they typically advise against it. And as someone who, you know, you're very well studied on them. Did you ever have any conversations or ask them any questions regarding short selling?
I did not in the forum of the asking a question at the Berkshire meeting. Mm-hmm. And in fact, by the way, now that they've made those all the recordings available, over the last 20 years, I've been to the last 21 consecutive Berkshire meetings.
That's amazing.
I think I've asked a dozen questions, and I have asked more questions in the last two decades at the Berkshire meeting than anyone else.
I was going to say, you probably have the record.
Yeah. But I did have a very interesting conversation with Charlie Munger years ago, and my goodness, I wish I'd listened to him. And this is in one of the modules that we teach called Lessons from 15 Years of Short Selling. Mm-hmm. Short selling... there were some incredible highs, but by and large, short selling was an extremely costly activity, both financially and sucking up huge amounts of my time and energy and bandwidth, mental bandwidth. And so my advice to most people is don't do it. Study it, learn about it. It's a very important, tool to have in your toolkit to understand it, but then don't do it.
I think for me and maybe other people, it's also a skill that you could learn to maybe avoid going long sometimes as well.
Correct. The reason I think it's very important to learn about short selling is it will make you a better long investor.
Right.
Some of the most dangerous long investments, the value traps. The ones that look cheap, but there's a bomb on the balance sheet. There's fraud. It's a rapidly decaying or declining business. So anytime, and we value investors are drawn to companies that are having trouble, right? Because we're betting on a turnaround. And the short sellers, of course, are betting that it's never going to turn around and that it's going to go to oblivion. And so anytime you're looking at a long idea and you see a 5% or greater short interest in the stock, it's absolutely critical that you figure out what the short thesis is, because you need to disprove that thesis before you can go long the stock, of course. So it's really important to have the mindset and develop the mindset of a short seller, to be skeptical, to not believe what management is spooning to you, to look hard at the debt levels, and what hidden off balance sheet liabilities there might be, whether there could be fraud, whether the business model is permanently broken or somehow unsustainable. You know, short sellers can only survive by being really smart. To survive as a short seller, you have to be 10 times smarter than to survive as a long investor, because basically you're swimming upstream most of the time. That's why I really believe in short selling. I think it's healthy for our markets. I organize a conference twice a year dedicated solely to short sellers coming and pitching their best short ideas. We teach a one-day seminar just on short selling. That said, my advice to most people is learn about it, but don't do it.
Yeah. Well, it makes a lot of sense. Would you are you open to sharing about that conversation you had with Charlie on short selling?
Yes. Thanks for the reminder. Yeah. So early in my career,
How long ago was this?
This was like 2002, 2003. So I was only a few years into my investing career. I was having some real success. My business was growing. I was full of myself. And Guy Spier, Bill Ackman, and I stumbled upon Farmer Mac, which was one of Guy Spier's largest long positions. And basically, it was sort of a Fannie Freddie kind of business making farm loans that were sort of government subsidized. So Guy Spier came and pitched the idea to an investing group I was part of, and I happened to mention to Bill Ackman that, hey, you should take a look at this Farmer Mac, this stock that Guy Spier pitched yesterday at our little meeting. And Bill Ackman called me back a couple days later, and he'd done a bunch of work on it, and he said, "Oh my God, Whitney, this stock is incredible." And I said, "You know, really, trading at 3 times book value and 35 times earnings, you think this is an incredible buy?" And he said, "No, as a short," he shouted into the phone. And so I called up Guy, and we went into Bill's office, and Bill had printed out hundreds of pages of annual reports and conference calls, et cetera. And he walked us through his analysis, showing us how the Farmer Mac was a total house of cards. It was not AAA rated. It did not have a government guarantee in the same way Fannie and Freddie did. And so we decided to go down, and we took a train down to D.C. to meet with the CEO, who Guy Spier had gotten to know because Guy was long the stock. Mm-hmm. It was a wild meeting. We got there, and the CEO started going through his generic slide presentation for investors. And about 5 minutes in, Bill Ackman cut him off. We'd obviously knew the slide presentation. It was, and Bill said, "I just have some questions," and started drilling in to all the flaws in the business. And the CEO started to get super uncomfortable. And eventually, about 10 minutes into this, said, "You know, maybe this stock isn't for you," and basically threw us out and ended the meeting.
Holy
and so
crap.
On the way back to New York on the train, all of us were looking at each other with wide eyes, like we knew that we had found a totally scammy company and a totally overvalued stock. So that was my first short ever. And then Bill wrote a piece. You could probably find it by Googling it. I think it was called Buying the Farm. If you just Google Bill Ackman Buying the Farm, you can go back and read. It was one of the first activist short campaigns ever. It led to a big New York Times article. And then Bill Ackman, 6 months or a year later, discovered MBIA, another company that he felt was AAA rated but didn't deserve it, was under-reserving, et cetera, et cetera. In fairly short order, Bill Ackman I was sort of amplifying. Bill was doing most of the work and publishing it. He was the front man.
Okay.
I was involved. I was mentioned in some of the articles, and I was amplifying using my writings and my email list and so forth. And sure enough, the companies are very powerful and politically connected. They picked the SEC and Elliot Spitzer on us, the New York Attorney General's office, and Elliot Spitzer on us, and the SEC on us, and accused us of market manipulation. And they planted a story in the Wall Street Journal accusing this cabal of short sellers led by Bill Ackman, mentioning me. I think David Einhorn and Guy Spier were all and within a day of that Wall Street Journal article, we all had subpoenas from Spitzer's office in the SEC. And, you know, I was only a few years into my investing career.
Maybe must have been terrifying.
It was absolutely terrifying. I thought my life was over. I thought my career was over. I'd just been smeared in the Wall Street Journal. And it was all bullshit, of course.
Yeah.
But I thought I was all over. So I called up Warren Buffett, who I was acquainted with. You know, he's been a mentor for many decades for me since I started my investing career. And I remember calling him up to ask for his advice because I really needed some wise advice. And he said, you know, Whitney, you guys haven't done anything wrong. This is just companies retaliating against legitimate critics. And don't worry about it. I know it feels very emotional right now. And that it's really bad, but trust me, this too shall pass. And then he said, but you know what? I'll bet Charlie has some comments on this. Why don't you give him a call? And I said, Mr. Munger, you know, I've never talked to him. Will he even talk to me? Does he even know who I am? And Buffett chuckled and said, oh yeah, he knows who you are. Give him a call. And so, you know, sort of hand trembling, you know, I got the phone number and I called up and his secretary put me through and I'm on the phone with my idol, Charlie Munger. And I still remember the conversation. It's, you know, imprinted on my mind. And he said, the first thing he said is, he said, Whitney, there's absolutely no question in my mind that you and Bill are correct in your analysis of MBIA. And he said, the idea, he said it in this tone of voice. He said, the idea that anybody would ever think that this company is AAA is so ludicrous, he practically shouted. And so I'm sort of thinking, you know, well, this is great. My hero is telling me that, you know, our analysis is correct. And then he says, but you know, Whitney, I think what you and Bill are doing in bringing attention, publicizing your short thesis here on MBIA, I think that's healthy for our markets. That said, my advice to Whitney Tilson is don't do it. Because, and here's the words he used. He used these exact words. He said, because Whitney, if you go around stepping on people's air hoses, they're going to hate you. And they're going to plant negative stories in the Wall Street Journal. And they're going to get Spitzer and the SEC to investigate you. And they're going to make you miserable. So my advice to you is don't do it. And then he went off on a little riff about short selling. And he said, you know, early in my career, I shorted three stocks. You know, I shorted the yen and a couple stocks. And he said, you know what? It eventually, they all three ended up working out okay. But a couple of them doubled against me before they worked out. And it really caused me a lot of sleepless nights. And I realized, you know, I realized pretty early on that this was just something that was just a bad use of my time and energy, and that I just swore I was never going to do it again, and I've never done it again. And then he paused, and he sort of, it was almost, he said in a self-reflective way, sort of chuckled, and he said, you know what, every young guy seems to have to learn this for himself. And that, those words haunt me to this day, because he was basically telling me, Whitney, Stop short selling entirely. And if you are going to short sell, shut up about it, because otherwise people are going to attack you and make you miserable. But most importantly, just don't short sell at all. It's a bad business. It's a bad use of your time and money. It's going to cost you a lot of sleepless nights and a lot of heartache. But then he knew I wasn't going to listen to him, because he knows young guys who are filled with their egos and going off on crusades against nefarious companies and all of that. So he was
what? You broke up.
He was giving me the best advice I've ever gotten.
Yeah.
But he knew I wasn't going to listen to him. And yeah. that's incredible wisdom on his part, and it makes me want to kill myself that I wasn't smart enough to listen to Charlie Munger early in my career. So I went off and for the next 15 years did more and more short selling, and it was one of the major contributors to the demise of my business. For the reasons I outlined earlier, I lost a huge amount of money doing it, with the very small exception of the 2008-2009 downturn, where I made a ton of money on short selling. Anybody did, right, back then. And I had a good year in 2015, when I really nailed Lumber Liquidators and a couple other stocks on the short side. But basically, other than, maybe a couple of years, for 15 years, short selling was bleeding me financially, and it sucked up enormous amounts of time. One of the great regrets of my investing career was I was on the phone with Charlie Munger, and he told me specifically and personally that I shouldn't do this. And he even told me that I wasn't going to listen to him. And he was right. Every young guy seems to have to learn this for himself. So let me tie this back to what Glenn and I are trying to do with Case Learning.
Yeah.
We're trying to teach a whole lot of young guys a whole lot of lessons that we learned the hard way. And it shouldn't be that every young guy has to learn this for himself. There should be enough smart people out there who are smart enough to listen to wiser, more experienced people and not repeat the same mistakes.
And some of them will and some of them won't, right?
Yeah, the thing is we teach so many lessons.
Yeah.
That if even 10% of them sink in just a little bit, on not just the calamities to avoid, but the smart things that you should do, like tighten up your investor letters, an example you just gave of something you took away from our seminar, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
If we're teaching so much valuable stuff, that if people take away and implement only 10% of it, they're getting an exponential return on their investment of time and money to come take one of our seminars or webinars.
Absolutely, and that's what I've said to people as well. I bet Charlie would appreciate it, if you gave him a call or wrote him a letter and just shared that story with him, that, this is where it panned out.
That's a great idea. I think I will.
Because he loves teaching. I think he'd resonate with that.
Yes.
It's funny, the might be the only time that I can remember, because I don't really get starstruck with people, but the only time my hands were ever trembling on the phone was when I was on the phone with Charlie Munger. So it's kind of funny you said that.
How did you end up on the phone with him? Because he's not easy to get on the phone.
It was a few years ago, and I had wanted to talk. I'd want to ask him a question, and I had called his office, and I was just calling to ask, what's the best way to write him a letter or something like that. And I called, and I would get a voicemail. It would be his assistant on the phone, and it would be the assistant, say, hey, we're out. I'm out on the phone, or I'm out for lunch. And it was like his assistant that would, that was the voicemail. So I called like three times that day, and it kept going to voicemail. So I figured, I'll call one more time. And Charlie picked up the phone, and I can feel my heart sink, and I go, oh, is Charlie Munger there? Like, knowing it was Charlie on the phone, but I didn't want to be like, hi, Charlie. Like, I didn't even know how to react. And he goes like, oh, this is Charlie. How can I help you? Or, something like that. And I said, well, and I went to this conversation, and we talked for like a half hour on the phone. It was like amazing. And I could not believe I was on the phone with one of my idols. It was incredible.
Wow. Sometimes, very wealthy, famous people who have lots of people reaching out to them, their secretaries are very good at protecting them. But every once in a while you get lucky. So congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Anyway, let's go. Anyway, back to you, though. So what's for the next year of Case Learning, what do you see happening? What do you see the future of this?
Yeah, well, look, we've spent the past, since I launched the business last October, taught my first group of a dozen students in December, we've developed we're constantly developing new case studies and content, but I think we've really got it to the point now where I'm really excited about what we're teaching. I think we've done a really good job of capturing all the lessons I learned over 20 years of being in the business, and not just my own personal lessons, but the lessons from observing so many other investors. I have an archive on my hard drive of hundreds of different investors, all their investor letters. You know, I've seen who's been successful and who hasn't been, and what are the mistakes people have made, what are the smart things people have done. So, I think we've developed some incredible content, both on becoming a better picking good stocks. That's what most people think it is. But it's also avoiding the value traps. It's also portfolio management, which can be as important as picking good stocks, is your portfolio management skills.
Yep.
And then on the entrepreneurial side, how do you build a business out of this? Because the entrepreneurial skill set is very different from the investing skill set. I see a lot of people get into this business because they're good investors, but it turns out they don't have the entrepreneurial skills at all, and they fail for that reason.
Yeah.
So we've got great content. The question is, you know, how to market it, and how to deliver the content in various different ways to different audiences. So we're going on the road. We're going to continue to teach in New York our in-person seminars every 3 months or so. So we're doing that in September, 2 months from today. We're doing it again in December, doing it again early 19. So every New York is the biggest investment market in the world. We're going to keep teaching here. Pretty much every month for the next 10 months, we're going to go do a week in a foreign city and see what kind of markets there are for what we're teaching around the world. So that's all the in-person stuff. We're also going to see how this webinar goes over the next it's a 9-day Lessons from the Trenches Investing Bootcamp plus a 3-day seminar on how to launch and build an investment fund. So that's 12 days that we're 2 days into that ends next Saturday. And then maybe we'll start creating some video content. We have a lot of free video stuff on our website. We have just go to YouTube and type in Case Learning, K-A-S-E. Stands for Catherine, Allison, Susan, Emily, my wife and three daughters, by the way, is where the name Case comes from.
All right on.
And so we're, we're trying to figure out, now that we've got this great content that I'm convinced that, I've been in the business for 20 years, and my goodness, what I would pay right now to send this content back to my younger self when I was early in the business. I would literally pay millions of dollars to do that, because that's how much my mistakes cost me. Tens of millions of dollars. Absolutely no question about it. When I grew from 1 million to 200 million, I thought I had died and gone to heaven. I thought I was successful and money was coming in. I now look back and realize I should have gone from 1 million to 1 billion, not 200 million, 1 billion.
Right.
That's how good my investment returns were in the first 12 years. And I could have used that money to build an infrastructure and hire a team and so forth that might have protected me from getting spread too thin and making a bunch of mistakes that eventually led to the demise of my business, right? Mm-hmm. I think the whole outcome could have been different. And, by the way, I would have made retirement money. I did well over 18 and three-quarter years, but I did not make retirement money. And that was a huge, huge, huge lost opportunity. This is the kind of business where you got to make hay when the sun shines. And I made hay. The sun was shining on me for 12 years. And I made some hay, but I only made about one-fifth of the hay I should have made, because I did not have an organized and effective fundraising, capital raising program.
Yep.
To really take advantage of the period in which I really hit it. I had great numbers and, was really high profile and so forth.
Yeah, well, I always think that, there's people, they make mistakes, or there's certain circumstances that happen to them that are out of their control. There's obviously both of those, and some people withdraw and kind of clamp down a little bit in life, and some people use those as opportunities to, make an impact and make a difference. And I respect, the shit out of you that you are, using things that you've learned and mistakes that you've learned to, you know, go out and do what you love, and which is teach and make a difference with people. So I think that's really cool that you're still, you know, you're still on your life mission, you know, regardless of what's happened in the past. And I think that's amazing.
Yeah. Well, thanks. I'm having a lot of fun doing it. I mean, look, every person should have a goal of finding work that they can make a living at, but most importantly, that they love, that they would do even if they didn't have to earn the money, right?
Yep.
And very few people actually achieve that. You know, the reality for most human beings on Earth is they have to do miserable work and book the hours and get paid by the hour doing something they don't really enjoy, because they got to make a living. They got to put a roof over their heads and feed their family, right?
I mean, it's hard enough to accomplish a goal in the United States. It's significantly harder in other places around the world, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And trust me, I've seen that, you know, growing up around the world, and my parents and my sister live in Kenya today. And, you know, life for the bottom couple billion people on Earth is pretty grim. So I'm not complaining about my lot in life. I've been the luckiest guy on Earth. And it's very frustrating and painful for me to recognize that I did not do as well as I should have done on the way up, and that I made, a bunch of mistakes, that in hindsight all seem obvious and ridiculous.
Yep.
That really cost me, my business. But it's almost been cathartic to teach it. And I feel good about trying to help other people, stand on my shoulders in the same way that, you know, not just Buffett and Munger, but Joel Greenblatt and Bill Ackman and Seth Klarman and all the people I learned from, you know, through their books or through sitting in on their class, like Joel Greenblatt's up at Columbia, or through them taking phone calls from me. You know, I achieved what I achieved by standing on the shoulders of others. So my goal, with Case Learning and with the rest of my life is to help other people, you know, young guys like yourself, stand on my shoulders, achieve even greater success, but also critically, warn you about all the mistakes and all the traps and the things that can lead to your undoing. Because achieving success is not just a function of doing smart things. It's equally a function of avoiding dumb things.
Yep.
And it's almost shocking to me how, you know, I think I'm a pretty smart guy, how many dumb things I did. And part of it was inexperience, because I never, paid my dues and did an apprenticeship and learned the business from somebody else. And part of it though was my ego and was my success. It was achieving so much success in the first dozen years out of the box, led to, humility going out the window, my ego running amok, thinking that I was a good short seller, thinking that I was a good stock trader, thinking that I was a good macro trader, thinking that I could do it all, that I didn't need to hire a team of people to support a growing business. Thinking that, you know, being mentally rigid and saying, you know what, you know, my old valuation rules of thumb, like, you know, never pay more than 20 times earnings, even for the greatest company. Well, that's a decent rule of thumb 95% of the time, but a really dumb rule of thumb 5% of the time. And so I missed some of the great stocks of our lifetimes because I had these blinders on, and part of that was ego.
Yeah. Whitney, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, okay. So. No, it's true. It's it goes to that principle of almost, you know, the concept of, like, you know, a winning formula, right? Where, you know, sometimes what gets you to a certain space in life is the very thing you need to let go of to get to the next space in life.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the things I've always admired about Buffett and Munger is that they simultaneously have never strayed. They've never abandoned their core principles. If you go back and you read the Buffett Partnership letters from 1958 through 1970, 72, and I was the first person who originally compiled them, and scanned them and made them available to the general public.
Thank you, by the way, for doing that.
You're welcome. It was one of the ways, by the way, that I built my business and built my name and reputation in the value investing world, was just going out there and hustling and scrapping and taking notes and publishing my notes from the early Berkshire meetings, coming across recordings of Charlie Munger's speeches and having them transcribed, compiling the most comprehensive set of Buffett's partnership letters. In fact, here's a funny story. When Alice Schroeder was writing Snowball, or beginning to write Snowball, mm-hmm. she went and met with Buffett, one of the pieces of information she wanted to write her book was, you know, she asked Buffett, could you give me a copy of all of your old Buffett partnership letters? And he told her, go ask Whitney for them. He has a more complete copy than I do.
That's
right.
Hilarious.
Like, that's a good way to build your name in
a new business, right?
So Buffett, getting back to my original point, is Buffett, he could have, every word in those partnership letters he wrote a half century ago, he could have written yesterday. Nothing has changed. I've been to 21 consecutive Berkshire meetings, and they give the same answers to the same questions if they get asked the same questions, right?
Right.
But they are not mentally, at the same time that they're incredibly consistent, they are not mentally rigid. And Buffett is putting almost $50 billion into Apple, a tech stock that he never would have done 10 years ago. He bought an Israeli company, Iskar, that he never would have bought years ago.
Yeah.
He almost did a deal with Uber a couple months ago, something he never would have done. And this guy's 87 years old, and Munger's 94 years old, and these guys are still on a very steep learning curve and are still opening their minds to the changing world and trying to adapt. And, you know, it's almost embarrassing that a younger guy like myself was not able to be mentally flexible and so forth. I actually had to lose my business, shut down my fund, and spend the last better part of a year now studying everything I did over 20 years so that I can then teach it to the next generation like you. It took that. And now I think I'm prepared to go out and be a much better investor with my new separately managed account business that I'm in the process of launching. And, I'm gonna avoid, all the mistakes that I made, in my first 20 years, because I plan to be doing this for another 50 years. I plan to live to be over 100, and I'm 51 right now. So I got another half century ahead of me to apply all the lessons that, unfortunately, I had to learn a lot of them the hard way.
Hey, with modern technology, it might be more than that.
Yeah, I hope so. I'm in pretty good shape. I eat pretty healthily. I exercise regularly, and I've got good genes. So I plan to live a long time.
Have you ever listened to much Rick Kurzweil from Google?
A little bit.
He's pretty fascinating. His book, The Singularity Is Near, like, mind-blowing book.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, hey, Whitney, I really appreciate you you coming on. I think, you know, what you're doing really speaks to sort of the essence of the value investing community, where I've just found people generally, there's a few jerks out there, but generally for the most part, people are very supportive. You know, people are willing to, you know, throw around ideas and, hey, you know, what do you think of this? Or I have this client and he's doing this and I don't know what to do. People have always been very generous, and I think what you're doing is just forwarding that generosity and strengthening our community. And I know a lot of other people really appreciate that. So thank you for all the all the contributions you've given to the value community over the years.
My pleasure. It's been a labor of love. I've really enjoyed, I feel an obligation to do it. There's sort of an ethos in the value investing world where Ben Graham, you know, taught Warren Buffett and then, you know, Buffett taught the next generation, and I'm just continuing that great tradition. in the value investing world, and actually doing it in the form of a business has actually gotten me to invest a huge amount of time and money into really trying to capture all that knowledge and communicate it in an effective way. So it's been a lot of fun, and I'm glad folks like yourself. I'm glad you had a good experience at the seminar. You'll definitely have to do the full Lessons from the Trenches bootcamp. I think you'd probably benefit from that as well. Anyone who wants to be a better investor, trust me, would benefit from that. But I'm glad you had a good experience doing the seminar, and I hope it's helping you build your business.
Yeah. So for people that want to learn more about your company, about you, what would be the best way to, either reach out to you or learn more information about your offerings? What would be the best way for that? And we'll include everything in the show notes as well.
Yeah. Well, the simplest thing is just go to caselearning.com, KASELearning.com. And you can also follow us. We have, I have both personal and, case learning, handles, on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, and we have a case learning YouTube channel. So we've put out a ton of, free content out there for people to learn from. We've done free webinars, that if you go to, just our YouTube channel, we've done free 2-hour webinars on an introduction to value investing. Lessons from 15 years of short selling, how to raise $1 billion, the fundraising process. So we've done a lot of free stuff that's about out there right now. You don't even have to pay to take one of our courses if you just want sort of the overview. So there are lots of different ways to connect and learn from the stuff we're putting out there.
Okay, great. Anything else you want to say? You think we should call it a day?
No, I think that's all. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, likewise.
Great questions. And perhaps we'll do it again. Don't catch the surface of some of the lessons I can impart to investors who are looking to learn and improve it, and maybe even launch their own business someday.
Yeah, well, I think it will be very interesting. I would love to have you back on after you've travel the world a little bit. I would, I think it would be really cool to hear some stories of, just your experiences in other countries doing this.
I'd be happy to come back and share.
All right, right on. Well, hey, Whitney, thanks a lot, and hope you have a great rest of your day.
All righty, thanks. You too. Bye-bye.
All right, take care.
Thank you for listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast with Eric Schlein. If you'd like to connect with Eric for questions, comments, feedback, ideas, or to inquire about being on the show, please contact Eric at intelligentinvesting@gmail.com. So, in the words of Charlie Munger, I have nothing to add.